The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Jennifer survives the crash, the bear, the crash of the bear. Roger advises 10,000 companies, that's the one with five zeros. More pitches gone wild, fraud, spies, and lies, and who knows what else? Well, why would who know what? We'll find out this week on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Welcome, Chris. Tell us your name, what you do, the name of your company.
My name is Chris Murphy. I work in cybersecurity research. My company is Existence Authentication.
All right. And what does Existence Authentication do?
We solve the online identity problem.
Okay. So that's a big, bold, huge statement. And you know that because you listened to the show before, that when Chris and I have a conversation following this, you know, we're going to probably try and rip that to shreds. So why don't you save us the trouble and tell us what actual problems it solves, because the identity problem seems like it's awful big. Just for clarity, you know, who are you? Who am I? Where am I going? You know, this is, everybody has this crisis in their teen years. You're not solving that problem, right?
No, we're solving the online identity problem.
Oh, so I'm online. I don't know where I'm going. And then what specifically are you doing? What's the nature of the problem and its size? And what's the solution that you bring to bear?
The nature of the problem is that 100% of online activity is based on an assumption of identity.
I'm sorry, an assumption of identity?
That's right.
Oh, so hang on. So when somebody goes to the all.net website or the A2E website or the cybershow.co website, we don't know or care anything about their identity. They're just welcome to come.
But that's public work. It's a public website.
But it's on the internet. So it's not 100% of internet activity has identity. It's got to be something where you actually care about identity, right?
Well, the identity threat issue is not a public internet issue. It's an internet issue for companies for their private activity. Information that does not want to be shared in the public. Information that will damage a company if it's shared publicly.
All right. So we're talking about confidentiality here, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, having said that, you know, and I'm pretty sure you're aware that my view of, you know, cybersecurity is that confidentiality is usually not the most important aspect of what's going on. Integrity, availability, use control, accountability, transparency, custody. There are a lot of other things that are important. You're solving the confidentiality of information being exchanged over the internet problem. Is that right?
No, I'm creating a digital state of existence for a human being on the internet.
Oh, hang on. A state of existence. I'm just trying to figure out what would be a state of a human being.
A state of existence.
So you're saying what, this is an actual human being that actually exists or what?
I can prove that you are either online or off.
You can prove that it's me?
Yes, and that you're either online or offline at any given moment.
All right, so like I close my eyes, I'm offline, I open my eyes, I'm online. How can you tell whether I'm online at any given moment?
Well, it's hard to do that when you are starting with assumptions that don't apply. So let's do this a little differently. You have, any company has two types of activity. That activity which they want shared with the public, and that activity which should not be shared with the public. If it's shared with the public, they will be damaged, correct?
Well, if you say so, I never agree with anybody, including myself. So don't worry about that part.
Okay. So if you have activity that will damage your company if it's shared with the public, then putting access to it on a public website damages.
Oh, that doesn't mean it's damaged. It has the potential for damage.
It introduces an unnecessary risk.
A potential. Yes. Okay.
Now, in addition to that, because you now have it on a public website, you're using a browser.
Well, we don't have to use a browser, but very often that's what we do because, you know, we use apps, for example, on a phone.
Okay. An app is a browser that does all the same things a browser does, except it connects to the company because it's installed. A browser is installed software that interacts on the internet.
Oh, so that's your definition of a browser. Okay. So what you're saying is whatever I use on the user end to communicate or to do whatever I'm doing with the company, and then on their side, they have whatever it is that I'm interacting on the other side. And you're those are the things you're talking about. So when you say when I'm using it, I take it if it's on my phone, for example, it would mean that I have the application open and showing on the screen, right?
Right.
And I'm actually interacting with it, right? Not the person sitting next to me who's also there, who's touching my screen with me or has a gun to my head, but me, I'm the one doing it, right?
Maybe.
All right. From
a company's point of view, the company only knows that your device is connected.
Right, of course.
They don't know who's using the device.
That's a big problem, but you solved that problem, right?
Yes, we do.
So you can tell the difference between me touching the screen and my wife touching the screen when she's sitting next to me.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. How do you do that?
We use a digital identification that is a totally self-contained VM.
It's a virtual machine. Initials are problems for us. All right. So yes, it's a totally contained, but it's not contained in my brain and it doesn't contain me. So how do you tell the difference between my finger and my wife's finger?
Well, your finger and your wife's finger are just data being sent across the internet.
No, but you said you can tell the difference between her
because we use a serialized digital identification, like an employee ID, that is assigned to an employee. So when the employee wants to do company private work, they must connect their ID to any type of device. It creates a virtual machine that directly connects to the company, asserts its digital identification, maintains connectivity, and allows for interaction. It installs nothing on the local machine, and it caches all session data on the ID itself. This is important. When the ID is plugged in, it exists on the internet, and because it directly connects, it exists at the company. When it's unplugged, it does not exist on the internet or at the company.
I understand all that, and everybody else understands all that, but you still haven't told me how the device then can tell whether my wife or I am the person interacting.
Because you're looking at it from the wrong perspective.
I'm looking at it from my perspective. You don't like the perspective.
But I'm not selling it to you as a consumer. I really, honestly, I don't mean this the way it sounds. I don't really care how the consumer feels about it. We're not selling it as a consumer product. This is a business to business. Our product is business to business.
And for you sold it to a company. You sold it to IBM, right?
Right.
And IBM, well, do they care if it's me or my wife touching the screen?
The IBM is going to issue their employees IDs, and that will be the only way they can interact with the company for private activity over the internet.
Yeah, but does IBM care whether it's me or my wife touching the screen?
Yes.
So how do you help IBM tell whether it's me or my wife touching the screen?
Because if your serialized ID is plugged in, then you have to provide your associated credentials, one-to-one relationship.
I've provided my credentials. My wife's still sitting next to me, and she wants to touch the screen, so I let her.
Then you're responsible for her actions.
Got it. Okay. Thank you. That's what I was trying to understand. Okay. So
we know it's you because it's your ID and your specific credentials let it in. So we know that you are directly asserting that your ID is connected and the credentials for the ID were provided. If anybody has it, either you provided your IDs and credentials or they couldn't have gotten there.
They could have taken it from me.
Absolutely. And it's your responsibility then to report it to the company that it's been lost or stolen. They trigger a switch that makes it self-destruct and they send you a new one.
Okay. You are aware of some instances. For example, there was a case in England, certainly it was in Europe, where somebody wanted to steal a Mercedes. So what they did was they cut the thumb off of the owner and used that to get into the car and authorize it to go, go, go. So that's how they stole it. So whatever the mechanism is, the biometric, whatever, if I put a gun to your head, you can say, yeah, well, it was indeed you that said, go ahead and use it. But I can't tell who was actually using it. I can only tell whose ID and that they, with whatever biometric they use, with whatever certainty there is associated with that, that we're certain that they were involved in the process, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, good. Now, let's talk about your company. So you make devices, right? These are physical devices that a company buys in bulk and provides to their, well, whoever it is that they want to be more sure about, right? Because they're not going to provide it to everybody in the world, you know, who could come into their website. That's the public stuff, right?
Right.
Yeah, so they give it to their insiders, and their insiders are then, they use that device to gain access, just like a CAC card, right? I think that's, what is that, a...
Common access card for office buildings.
Common access card, yeah, which was originated, I guess, by DOD, Department of Defense, for use in eliminating unauthorized access to their online facilities, right?
Well, it was for their physical facilities.
Well, no, but it was also online, right? You could use it remotely.
But that's a different thing completely. That's their CIPRNet. That's a different thing completely.
Okay, well, there's also other nets besides CIPRNet, but all right, I got it. So let's talk about your company. So how long have you been around?
The technology was originally introduced in the marketplace in 2010.
So that's after, long after there were the CAC cards in the in DOD, right?
Correct.
All right. So is your technology better than those?
Substantially.
Aha. So, ooh, cool. Tell us, how are they better?
CAC cards do not do direct assertion on the internet. The issue on the internet is that we all start in the wrong place.
You're telling me how they're worse. I want to know how you're better.
How we're better. We eliminate the ability for browsers to connect, or anyone in the public to connect, to a private location for access to private activity. If a company has something that private, then we allow them to set up a private URL where they could link that private activity. And the only people who can connect to that URL are people they issue identification to. What we create, not in effect, what we create scientifically is by definition true multi-factor authentication that meets strict regulatory compliance. On the internet today, literally every single MFA product.
Hang on. MFA, you're using those initials again.
Multi-factor authentication.
There you go. That's where you have more than one factor. It's not just a password. It's a password plus your iPrint and your
No, stuff, your no. All of those things are all still one-factor authentication.
No, but the multi-factor is when you have more than one of them simultaneously, right?
You don't have. You on the internet today, you never have more than one factor simultaneously.
Oh, well, so you're saying it's not multi-factor when they send a text to my cell phone in addition to the password that I use.
Correct.
So I use my thumbprint to get into my cell phone. That's one factor, and my password's a second. But you're saying that's not multi-factor.
It's multi-factor at your phone. It's not multi-factor at the company.
Okay, I see. So I think you're transporting our stuff to the company. All right, however that works. All right, so look.
No, it's not however that works. This is what we solve. If you go, everything after this is either corrupted or corrected right here. This is why cybersecurity fails, because we use single-factor authentication on the internet. We call it multi-factor authentication. It's now commonly referred to as common usage multi-factor authentication. It's certified as compliant with multi-factor authentication. And yet the science has been published both by federal agencies and by scientists and by assorted business people, demonstrating that what we do on the internet is multi-factor gathering at a local device, where data is that, where the factors are rendered to data, they are transferred to a remote location where multi-factor authentication becomes multiple sources of data compared to a single data set. And if the match is made, they assume that the data and the match are correct. So they take the identity associated and they assign it to whoever who provided it. And they make an informed guess and grant you access, whether it's the bank or DOD or your business. Everybody makes the same assumption of identity.
Oh, and you've solved that. So now your device eliminates that possibility in every possible way.
It directly asserts identity. That's different. Now, how that is applied in every company may be unique. But direct assertion of identity allows us now to establish your existence on the internet. Now, really, can I explain multi-factor authentication so you understand?
You can, but...
Let me help you, because it's really important. Multi-factor authentication was created based on an ATM model. And when it was originally written, it said multi-factor authentication for banking in an electronic environment. Okay. Now, when it was designed, it had two things that were important when these factors were put in place. One is we were talking about a closed network where the bank controlled all of the ATMs and the bank controlled the network between the banks. In addition, the bank controlled access because they issued you a debit card or credit card to put into the ATM. Now, in order for you to perform multi-factor authentication, in order for you to use an ATM, you have to physically be present at the ATM to put your card in to take the money out. That's the is factor. If you put your fingerprint down, you're providing data that is, yes, it's valid on your phone and it's valid for Amazon when you're checking out of one of their stores because your body is physically present. But if you go onto the internet and you put your fingerprint down, what you're doing is you're providing your fingerprint at the device that you're at. It's being rendered to data and sent to the bank. The bank no longer controls the network because access to the bank is on a website and it's using a browser taking data from an anonymous person. Now, think about this. You go to your bank today and you open up a website and you put your username and password in. That's data. They send you code. You put a code in. That sends them data. They read your fingerprint. It sends the bank data. They take your facial recognition. It sends the bank data. We do cognitive movements of your screen. It sends the bank data. When the bank performs authentication, the bank has multiple sources of data, one single factor, which is a direct violation of regulatory requirements.
So, Chris, what do you think?
So, kids, you know, we try to get some lessons across on this show, right? You know, and engineers, you know, and you know, look, if you want to work in cybersecurity and you want to talk to people, then you got to learn that words are tools, right? And all I got from that is that I'm not buying that, right? Because, you know, you're argumentative and you're basically saying, asserting that everyone's wrong and condescending when any question is, you know, given to that. And if you're going to get into the cybersecurity world, you're going to get questioned harshly by everybody. And any bold assertion you want to make, you know, you better be able to deliver it, be able to back it up. You better be able to explain it in the time remaining. And I know the identity question real well. And there isn't a bloody thing I heard there that tells me there's been any change to the state of the identity problem on the internet.
Okay. Well, so let's just ask some specific points. So this private URL you can only connect to if you have his device. Are you familiar with anything that may have done that sometime earlier?
No, that's well, yes. Well, yeah, right, right. Yeah, yeah. The individual steps look, you know, I frankly am just so annoyed by the whole conversation that, you know, I would still like to hear what technical solution is, you know, practically applied in the real world we're really talking about here. But all I heard is a lot of catchphrases and, like you say, things that have already been done before. So, what is it specifically? So, we've got a virtual machine and it only exists and it's a VPN back and, you know, strong identification and multi-factor. Nice. Okay, great. But again, there's no explanation. You're making a bold assertion. He's making a bold assertion and getting angry that it's not accepted and answering that with a bunch of belligerence. And that's not the way to convince people of anything, much less the complex trust-based things that we need to do with cybersecurity.
So, you used to work for a company that had a method wherein you could not connect if you weren't authorized, right? You couldn't even see that the resource was available. Do you remember that by any chance?
Every one of them? You know, which one?
just your most recent large employer that had that capability.
Well, Unisys. Yeah, Unisys Stealth. Yeah, that's a great micro segmentation. It's an application of VPNs down to the layer 2, you know, really tricky little way to say you cannot join the group, doesn't respond to layer 3 and so forth. That's really cool. Yeah, stealth is a neat thing. Even that's really hard. Yeah, you know, it's really hard to take these technologies and apply them in the real world. And that's, you know, again, for this segment, my main message is maybe this person has the fantastic technology and the answer, but I guarantee, you know, if that's the approach to describing it and selling it, it's not going to, if it solves all the world's problems and no one ever hears about it because you can't figure out, you know, how business works, then I guess it doesn't solve all the world's problems.
All right. Now, when I started asking questions, he started out by saying everything, everywhere. And right. then after I asked some more questions, he get down to, well, nothing public, of course. It's only the private stuff, right? So, okay. Right. And then we get, well, it's not integrity or authentic. It's none of that. It's just privacy. So confidentiality, right? So privacy, confidentiality. All right. So that's one slice of that pie. And then it's not for regular people. It's only for corporations, right? And as you slice it further and further and further, one of my problems is, what is the space left?
Right. Yeah. Secret world, you know, agents working for federally funded, I don't know, right?
Well, the reason I was asking those questions is because I was trying to get to the business issues, which he didn't really let me get to. But generally, we talk about this notion of a total addressable market. That is, you know, right. The actual people that would buy it, what's it worth? He seemed to not want to go there and at the same time went there. Then we talked about the CAC cards, the cards used by the military, which he asserted was only used for physical access, but I know for a fact that it's also used for, you plug it in on your side of an internet connection to an authorized device, and it'll allow you to network with somebody somewhere else in another authorized location with another authorized device. But he seemed to dismiss that. So he asserts he has something different. We don't know what it is, right?
Yeah, you know, cybersecurity is all about trust, right? And business is all about people. And again, if any cybersecurity solution is somehow trying to implement, enforce, you know, or enhance trust, and if the best you can do in describing it in spoken words to someone is doubt, then your product actually works, but it no longer matters because, you know, you've demonstrated that you at least are not the one to be delivering that to increase trust. I try to be kind, but, you know, this, and I'm trying to be, you know, sort of neutral about this. Like, look, this happens all the time. In our industry, there's a lot of this. A lot of people, really big egos, big, you know, huge brains that can think really fast and come up with all sorts of things, and the social skills of, you know, a wooden pallet, right? You know?
Well, so let's talk a little bit about, there's a difference between thinking fast and talking fast.
Right.
So, you know, people talk, this guy was not talking particularly quickly, that which is fine, but there's also the softening of the voice, right? He softens his voice when he wants to say something to get you to listen, and that's right. That's when it's important we lower our voices, whereas when you're screaming, it doesn't count, right? So, but when he lowered his voice, to me, I didn't see any increased value except for the lowering of the voice, so maybe that's a skill in communicating that I need to perfect. Now, another interesting thing he said was that when the banks implemented ATM machines, automated teller machines, they had a bank-controlled network between the bank locations. Is this reflective of your recollection of how communicate? No.
Yeah, no, I don't remember banks, you know, rolling miles of cable underneath the streets of America. No, they did not have their own private networks.
Okay, so they were trusting somebody else's network for the communication, right?
Oddly enough, yes.
All right. Now, let's talk about the other things in the discussion. So, and this, I don't want to talk about the specifics here because I don't, you know, have anything particularly negative for this person. It's a thing in the cybersecurity community that we've encountered all the time. And it's really important, I think, for the audience to understand the nature of this. This is not a unique circumstance. And we don't know whether this is, in fact, the most brilliant thing ever. Right?
Right. Maybe. Right.
Well, so I have my strong doubts, but the issue is, as you start to question the claims, and by the way, this wasn't even anything like an extreme claim. I mean, yes, it was way beyond the reality of it, but we've seen much more extreme claims than this one, right?
Yes, we solved cybersecurity. Yes.
Yeah, right. I like the one that says, the last cybersecurity product you will ever buy.
You'll be out of business after the whole business is hacked
It is the last one you'll ever have to buy, but not for a good reason.
Right.
All right. So this whole process of people that have their focal point and imagine that it's much, much larger than what it is. That's, it's like a disease. And we talk about the engineer's disease, right?
Right. Well, and you and I mean, you know, Fred and I, you know, to be clear, we struggle with this in very, very different ways, right? You know, I will, you know, anyways, I'll do it. I have my own faults and I try to have compensating mechanisms because I get really excited and I think everybody else is too, blah, 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 right? Okay, the point here is that if you want to be successful in this industry, you have to be self-aware enough. I mean, let's rephrase that. You can be successful, you know, and be, you know, deeply in the spectrum and not very good with human communication and, you know, do great work by yourself. And that's great. That's wonderful. A lot of my friends are like that. But, you know, if you really want to, you know, interact with people and deliver messages and so forth, not just be, you know, not be making the code, but be making the pitch, you got to be self-aware, you know, and like Fred just said, you know, this is a very, 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 it's a stereotypical problem in the cybersecurity community. Go figure, you know, we're the chess club on steroids. Right, you know, we're a very interesting bunch of folks. So, yeah, now, but we're that smart, so we should be able to figure this one out.
Well, there's right. How smart can you be if you're not smart enough to figure out why it is you're not succeeding? And of course, the answer is different people are smart in different ways, and that's why it takes a team in most cases. And somehow right. The notion is that the super. You know, these people that start a company and become billionaires in their 20s and you know, all this, and then they go out and everybody, you know, sort of comes and says, oh, I've got to hear from you. You must know everything about it. And my experience is the opposite, that for however it is they succeeded, and more power to you, you succeeded. But, you know, that drives into this belief, I think, within most of them, that they succeeded because they're better than everybody else around them. When, you know, there are all sorts of factors in their success, but being better than other people is not one of them.
Well, you know, and yeah, you know, I'm going to go straight into philosophy, right? Because, you know, Minnie Graham, you know, Minnie Gay, Minnie Gay, was an amazing, you know, person, you know, achieved incredible things, you know, success beyond measure. And it's my grandmother, who was born in the panhandle of Florida as a sharecropper's daughter, had five kids, took them out of poverty, you know, raised them as a single mother in New York City, you know, from the, yeah, and look, you know, a lot, you know, you don't have to be me or Fred. You don't have to be, you know, the talky face person to be successful in life. You don't have to be rich. You don't have to start a good business to be successful in life, right? Yeah, and in this industry, you don't have to be me who talks all the time. Most people in this industry, or, you know, we're heavily weighted towards, you know, the autism spectrum, right? You know, a lot of people have a lot of anxiety issues and really don't like talking to the people at all. And they're the best cybersecurity people on earth, and they have fantastic jobs and great lives, right? But if you want to choose to be, cross that line and be the human communications person, yeah, you know, be smart enough to figure out your own problems. Don't make me do it.
Well, you'll take fees for it, right?
Yeah, no, actually, no.
Oh, you mean you'll no longer allow people to pay you to help solve their communications problems?
Oh, well, I mean, this one is so, you know, honestly, I don't know this individual. I wish them great, you know, happiness in life. They need training or to pick a different vocation.
I want to get away from the individuals because
we
hammered on that. But the hammering is not out of any malice towards the individual. It's towards the issue of how people behave in this spectrum. And
let's assume the technical solution we're talking about is, in fact, unbelievably fantastic, solves huge problems in the world. In that case, I don't know this, but it could be true. You know, I don't know if it's not true. If that's true, then this inability is causing harm in the world because the inability to convince people, you know, to explain how good this is means that we can't have better security. It's not, you know, not aggressively against anyone or anything. It's just, how do we solve this problem? And security people do a bad job of selling security. We sell more bad security, you know, than we do good security. And quite often the best security in the world is made by people who are really terrible at explaining it. So we don't get to use it.
Right. On the other hand, some really great explainers are out there for some really crappy security solutions. And we end up using them and suffering under the consequences. Yeah. So now there's a whole other, you know, whole bunch of sides to this issue, right? To me, first of all, I have no belief whatsoever in what he's talking about as meeting any of the assertions that he says about it. But that's how I feel about everything. Right? It's like, I'm not unique. Right? It's like, it doesn't matter what you tell me, I'm skeptical. Right?
Yep.
In cybersecurity, because I've spent enough years in it that I know that nothing is really as good as you'd like it to be. It's all about, you know, better than or worse than the alternatives. And,
you know, well, it's one of the tools you use, right? You know, like I say, you and I approach this totally differently, but I know you, I pay attention, and you do this. You say, I would like to shorten this whole process, and you, so you pop out those sort of things and see if they can navigate around them. And because you've seen it all the life, right?
Okay, so in my experience, years and years of this, every like 5 or 6 years, and I talk to lots and lots of people, every 5 or 6 years, I start down those questioning things. You know, I ask the question, ask, and I find somebody who not just has the answers, but says something that's truly inspirationally interesting. And right. Those are like diamonds. You know, it's like unbelievable. And I immediately, I shake their hand. I say, oh, it's fantastic. Well, that's wonderful. I'd love to meet you. It's great. Let's work. Let's do something. Anything I can do to help, let me know. Mm-hmm. But it's so rare.
You know, this conversation reminds me of I'll share this story, right? You know, so you know, Fred and I were engaged by a cybersecurity vendor, and we met with them, and they claimed that they had an unhackable product. And, you know, it's a friend of mine in the Silicon Valley offices in our usual, you know, sort of environment. And there was a whiteboard, and I went and got a coffee. I remember came back, and you were on number 5, right? And this is, you know, to the point of our conversation, these people weren't frauds. They're actually very good. It was a neat product. But they allowed themselves to, you know, fall prey to the weakness we're talking about and say, hey, this is unhackable. It's like, well, except for this specifically, this. I think he came up with 26.
But it was, I only have half an hour, Chris. What do you want? If they would have paid me more, I could have been there and given them another 25 in the next half hour.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Just pull a double. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their gee-whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. Robo-taxis in San Francisco stopped for 15 minutes, causing massive traffic jams during the lunch hour. They blamed the cellular network, apparently necessary for cars to run. Scores of emergency fire and rescue vehicles have also been disrupted. San Francisco, accustomed as it is to cyber disasters, is thinking about making another movie. That's breaking news on The Cyber Show. How do we know we're being successful at The Cyber Show? Well, here are the 5 ways we know today. 1. We know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. 2. We know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. 3. We know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4. We know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5. We know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Roger Royce is one of the most well-known and well-positioned attorneys working on cyber issues, particularly in the ag tech arena, but also in many other areas. He also has a tremendous understanding of influence and related issues, as we'll see in our discussions.
Back with Roger, we're talking about all sorts of things. So we started talking about your career, and you knew when you were 12 years old that you wanted to be a lawyer because they had all the magic. Can you walk us forward through a little bit more of your career? Because eventually, you know, you decided in your career, I guess, after you got your law degree that you were going to go into specific areas. So talk us through, first of all, where did you go to law school and how did that all happen?
Yeah. So again, I saw law as really being fundamental to understanding business, and I saw accounting as a language of business. So I'm also a CPA. My undergrad is from my home state of North Dakota. My law degree is from there, and I have an advanced law degree from New York University, an LLM in tax. And I started my career I started in the Midwest, and then moved to New York City, worked on Wall Street as a tax lawyer for a few years, and came out to Silicon Valley temporarily 30 years ago.
And stayed.
Yeah, and that happens a lot. Someone once told me, said, everyone should live in California but leave before they get too soft. But I came
in. Hang on a second. So this puts you in a truly rare breed, right? A lawyer and a tax expert and a CPA. And there are very few people that meet those requirements. And it turns out, especially for startups and for companies looking at going public and companies looking to buy and sell other companies or themselves, those are very specific specialties that are very hard to come by and critically important. Can you talk to us about that specific set of things and how you came to that set and how elite is that crowd?
Yeah, you're right. I found it to be a good combination in my career. I think of it as business tax. So in other words, my clients, they tend to be a little more tax sensitive, right? I mean, I can do the standard, you know, corporate Silicon Valley deal, which are mostly handled by paralegals, let's be honest. But
they're handled by paralegals at $500-$600 an hour.
Yeah, I mean, the point being is that it's just paper and it's standardized documents, and the market is super efficient, and we don't get that much variability. I mean, that's why you see so many online tools popping up that will do things like incorporate you. Robots can incorporate you. They can even draft your financing documents. They can even put your investment funds together. Right?
LegalZoom, right, does a lot of this stuff. It's very efficient, very inexpensive. It works just great.
Well, all that stuff works until it doesn't. Where I get involved is to clean it all up, because there is still, you know, even artificial intelligence has not gotten to the point where it can replace judgment. And I've got a couple of books out, as you know, and I talk about this at length in my last book, 10,000 Startups, how artificial.
So have you actually done legal work for 10,000 startups?
I've figured it out. I've probably talked to that many, because there was a time there when I'd get a half dozen a day would call.
Oh, yeah, you'd come in for a free consult. I mean, I was with one of those companies that came in, and we spent an hour and a half with you, and then signed up for a little bit of work after that. But so you think it really is in the range of 10,000 companies you've talked to?
It's a lot. It's thousands for sure. Definitely that many that I've talked to. The number that have become clients is in the thousands. I don't know the exact number. I've been doing this for almost 40 years.
You ran an event at one point. You know, your Royce Law, your law firm before you changed, ran an event in the ag tech world that was really the best event anywhere ever, right? I mean, there must have been hundreds and hundreds of companies every year there, right?
Wow, well, thank you. Yes, we still do that event every year. It's the Silicon Valley Ag Tech Conference, Agriculture Technology. And it is an awesome event. We've launched some of the biggest companies in the space because we've been doing it for 10 years when they were just ideas here in the Valley and from around the world. People come from around the world to our conference. We shouldn't even call it Silicon Valley Ag Tech, because it's companies from around the world, but they have that Silicon Valley.
And really, Silicon Valley is not where the ag tech is. The ag tech is mostly in the Salinas Valley.
Well, I don't know. It's all over. You know, it's wherever the markets are. Let me put it that way. St. Louis has a hub for sure. Austin's getting there. Chicago has their own different thing. I mean, I've done these events all over the world, and you'd be surprised. Atlanta has a hub. Next is probably going to be Florida. We'll probably do something in the Miami area. I'm just now we're starting a farm bureau in San Francisco.
Because there is a lot of farming in houses and really niche farms, little areas where people farm things for their restaurants. This whole farm the food for your own restaurant business is fascinating.
Yeah, and there's a grow local movement. Consumerism is a big push behind a lot of the tech that's coming. In fact, there's tech that's getting into the market now that when I first saw it 10 years ago, didn't have a chance because it wasn't consumer, it was very much based on the consumer, and they didn't care as much 10 years ago as they do now, is my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, an example of this is these little grow things. You know, they're 3x3, 3 foot by 3 foot by 5 or 6 feet. You know, they you can grow enough plant food, enough vegetables and such for a family of two or three to live day by day by day indefinitely, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of them. The problem, of course, with vertical and urban farming and what we call controlled environment ag is it's a little bit challenging trying to get the profitability. But, you know, that's a lot of new businesses. They're definitely going to get there. And the more the consumers want to know provenance, they want to know where their product comes from, and they want it to be local, and they want to not have to be shipped across the country, the more that's going to come along. So eventually we'll be getting pineapples grown in my home state of North Dakota.
So actually, you know, one of the companies that we have in our portfolio does this. They build high-tech greenhouses near cities, near populated areas. So, you know, half of the cost of food is shipping. So it dramatically reduces the cost of providing, and it's, you know, it can be the best food you can imagine, right? So it's grown, you know, without any diseases. It's under surveillance the entire time. You know, you can do it very, very healthy. You can do it all organic and so forth. So I think that's a fabulous area, and that's a tremendous growth industry.
So you start to see how heavily embedded it is in the cyber world. And we're talking about the automation of contracts. Oh, yeah, it works fine until it doesn't. Okay. Right. So right now, as you're aware, we're in the process of forming one company every month. That's the goal, at least for a year in cybersecurity. And we're the first one is just about ready to get formed right now. And we're walking through the process. And so naturally, you know, Roger is my lawyer for this stuff. So I send him because it's such a rare thing to both, you know, be a lawyer, you know, for securities law and a CPA and a tax expert. You know, this is truly rare and really critical for a whole lot of stuff, you know, to keep you out of trouble. You know, I bring my sort of standard agreements and the other standard agreements to him, and he sends, you know, we talk about this, he sends me the document that describes in detail, this is the lawyer's briefing for other lawyers about these various kinds of terms and conditions. Oh my goodness. All of a sudden, you know, you talked about this previously when talking to Roger. All of a sudden, you probably have a 200-page document to form a company instead of a 5-page document. So, you know, I'm going back and forth about this stuff, and you read through it. Well, because I'm in California, these things apply. Okay, but the company's not in California. Oh, but if it's more than 50% owned in California, no, we've been very careful not to 50% own it in California because we didn't want to be subject to this. All right, well, where is it owned? Well, you know, there's a combination of people in different, oh, well, each state has this different set. So now, my goodness. So I've actually seen an investment contract that involved 50 states. And it had different clauses for each state saying, if you're from this state, then blah, 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 blah. And then their preferences, right? So different investors get different preferences depending on when they put the money in. You know, if you come in early, you get some preferences or you won't come in early. You know, so now you look over the preferences and you say, well, for this particular preference, if you say it this way, this happens, you know, but if you say it that way, this could happen to you. Oh, and by the way, there's the risk of that thing. And then there's this thing. And then you talk to them about insurance. And now, okay, directors and officers insurance, D&O it's called. So the price costs about $10,000 a year to get directors and officers insurance for a new startup that's only a couple $100,000 startup. It's, you know, it's 5% of the cost of the company. Apparently, it's going up and up and up. And of course, different providers have different costs, and you can't tell what they're actually insuring in any case. So he explains what the insurance will actually make a difference on. And we start to say, well, but I don't do this. Okay, so we don't have to worry about that. And when I don't, then, well, just make sure you never do that. Okay. So, and then there's always this thing that can happen anyway. Okay, so that's the last case. And that's where you can't do anything other than D&O insurance. Okay, so now we have to either accept that risk or, you know, try to mitigate it with more contract language. And, oh, you can't use that language. You know, in this state, you can't bypass that. It's such an enormous rat hole.
Right. There's this irreducible complexity problem, right? You know, I feel this way about the medical system, cell phone plans, right, insurance coverage. You know, I basically don't believe it at a certain level. You know, but, you know, I'm willing to take the general shape of it and on face value, knowing that in reality, there's so many exceptions and so forth, insurance, if everybody hasn't been through this personally themselves, they know directly people who have, it's like, had all the great coverage, had all the things. However, turns out that if you get this and this and this and they all line up, you don't get any coverage. How would you know that in advance? Right? Who has gotten a crazy cell phone bill after actually being pretty diligent and selecting the right thing and everything else? But, but there's this condition and that condition. And, the average person can't, like all of the cybersecurity things we're always talking about, the average user is sitting there going, I just need to pick something. I need to move forward, right? So, folks like Roger and processes like this, are critical to make the decisions about how much clarity you need to make choices.
I think that a lot of this is intentional.
Yeah, sure.
Right. And I also think that the solution to a lot of it is, and I hate to say it because I'm not a fan of regulation, but the solution is regulation.
Or at least consequences, transparency. Well, I'll share this one. I was on a plane, it was probably 20 years ago. But sitting next to me was a lady who was an executive with a major medical health insurance company. And she left, finally, and started a nonprofit, a customer advocacy organization, because of all sorts of things. But the one she told me about, because this is still back, this would be the 90s, right? So there's a lot of paper around. And there's a completely unwritten rule that if, someone leaves, a claims adjuster or whatever leaves, what you do is you walk over to their desk, you take all of the papers and you shred them.
So there's no evidence.
Right. Well, so if you're one of the, patients out there, one of the customers of this insurance company, you now have to start all over again to get your claim processed. And 70% of people won't, which is sheer cash profit back into the insurance company's hands. And you do it because wink, wink, nudge, nod, all your competitors are doing it. If you don't, whatever. So I think, regulation maybe, but at least transparency. So look, you can't just walk over the desk and shred all the paper and no one's going to know. that's where we get corruption, grit in the systems, and the systems work against the purpose.
Okay. Now, next thing to talk about here, just because he said it, 10,000 companies.
Right.
Just think about the magnitude. I mean, I've been to his conference. I worked with him previously for a brief period of time. We had a company that was trying to form to do funding for other companies and went into his office and had a meeting. Oh, yeah, a meeting. You get a half hour meeting for free to talk to a lawyer as an introduction. And this was one of 16 meetings that day that he had for a half hour each because it's an 8 hour workday. So, that times a week, right? That's, 80, 50 weeks a year. That's 1,000. Okay. Yeah. You can get to 10,000 companies. Yeah. In fact, you can get there in 2 years, right?
There's a 10,000 hour expertise cliche truism out there where everybody's pretty familiar with. You do something for 10,000 hours and you'll pretty well be a master at it. Right.
Yeah, except not in the law and not in cybersecurity, because as much as you think you're a master, it keeps changing. And so you have to keep putting in those hours to keep up.
Right. But the reason I mention that is because everybody's familiar with that one. But, it takes, at our ages, right? And Roger's, same sort of age range you and I are. It takes 30 years, right? But you can get there, sooner or later. Yeah, like you say, I was doing the same math in my head, listening to you talking to Roger and you can talk to 10,000, I'm a really talky person. I have a sort of unusual number of direct contacts, friends, people I assume are friends and experiences because I've been doing it for decades and lots of it. Right. So yeah, it's fascinating. 10,000 companies, right. You can see it. It's not that it's a lot. But if you're a hard-driving lawyer who's done this for decades, then you might have that level of experience. That's awesome.
All right. So I don't want to talk about connections on LinkedIn or email lists or any of those sorts of things, but 10,000 is certainly in the range. I know you've almost certainly communicated, in more than trivial depth to 10,000 people across the course of your career, as have I, as have many others that we interview on this show. It's just that it seems like such a huge number. 10,000, I've probably formed or been part of the formation of maybe it's 100 companies across my lifetime. And I feel as if, that's a lot. But like, as usual, right? So I've probably been to, 50 countries in my career, but I haven't started programs in the middle. Tom Johnson, 36, 37, 30, keeps ticking off, right?
Yeah.
And so the individual in the world is irreplaceable. There's something about that level of experience and knowledge and expertise and effort that everybody is different, but also their experiences are, even though they're so similar, they're so they are sufficiently different that you just can't replace any person.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking here with Jennifer Bayuk. Jennifer was one of the first chief information security officers on Wall Street and has a long and storied career before and after that.
So we're back with Jennifer. She's now the newly minted CISO of Bear Stearns, having not been informed of it until she was told to at a conference. She was announced at it, and then she met the CEO who said, oh, what? And she said, what? And there you have the movie. So a couple of years later, you're still at Bear Stearns, and let's what happened next, and then what did you go and do?
Well, one of the business units that always gave us a bit of a pause when it came to security review and security architecture review was that mortgage area that bought mortgages and resold them as packages in tranches. Now, my department was responsible for reviewing every system that went into production to make sure that it complied with our security policies and standards. They put a system on the internet that allowed people to sell them mortgages, and they didn't have standard authentication. They weren't following our single sign-on. They were not verifying the integrity of the data that was uploaded. They were just taking zip files of
whatever you send me, I accept it. It's mine. Okay.
Yes.
So there's no problem there. Nothing. What could possibly go wrong with that, right?
And I'm sitting in conference calls saying, well, how does one verify a mortgage? Well, the title company. Okay. Let's ask the title companies to verify this data. They won't. Well, then perhaps we
shouldn't be relying on it. Okay.
I escalated that to my boss, and he said, go talk to the chief risk officer. I went and talked to the chief risk officer, took me very seriously, did whatever he has to do, and Bear Stearns melted anyway because of those mortgages. I wasn't able to stop it. He wasn't able to stop it. The chief risk officer, by the way, got a very good job at the Fed after Bear Stearns died. So he was not blamed for the
But nor were you, right?
Nor was I.
Okay, good. So you're not blamed, but you're looking now what, right? You're looking for a job, and your resume says Bear Stearns in charge of making sure that what happened didn't happen.
So I was offered a position by JP Morgan, who went and bought Bear Stearns, but I was also able to say I'm ranking high enough where I get to choose if I choose the package or to stay here. I chose the package. Now, I don't know if that's very well advertised, but at the time I had that choice and my boss wanted me to stay. I knew that everything I did at Bear Stearns, like in my daily job function, had at least a whole department doing it at JP. So there was no, I would never have that bird's eye view, at least at that moment. You know, if I'd stuck around and tried to get myself promoted, I might, but there were plenty of people above me, and that was a completely different culture. You know, we were just kind of seen as cowboys at Bear Stearns compared to JP Morgan. Yeah.
So without going into details, the package you got, let's just say theoretically, could you have then retired or,
No, but I did go to graduate school and get a PhD.
And that's how you get promoted.
And again, all the parallels. Bear Stearns was a big customer of mine. You know, at that time, I was running the firewall lines at Cisco, and we sold lots of fixing to Bear Stearns. So it was an interesting period.
To me, you know, the path to promotion is just, it's ridiculous, right? Oh, you know, the 9/11 happened, so the Electronic Crimes Task Force, which I was also on before that time. I probably met her there. I just didn't even know that this is the same her at the time. It's the classic story of happenstance. And I don't think most people have this in their lives. I think most people just live their lives moving step at a time and never end up at this jump shift position of all of a sudden, you know, huh? Oh, by the way, of course, no additional salary. She had a title.
Well, and again, but it's this ratcheting effect, right? You know, the things happen, you know, enthusiasts, security enthusiasts always say, you know, we could do it this way, but it's not done that way. And if it's really necessary, at some point it ratchets forward. And security being security and, you know, be at the center of conflict, you know, 9/11 was, you know, another big ratcheting effect. You know, as we discussed, as Jennifer has said, you know, already in her career, and you and I and all of our colleagues and so forth, and those periods working on other things, and they just, you know, keep moving forward. You know, the in the supply chain world, you know, the SBOM forum, the interesting conversation happens every Friday, where, you know, I not associated with an acronym, you know, not associated with the federal government or any of the nonprofits, just a bunch of folks getting together and pondering this whole supply chain stuff. And we're talking today about PURLs, product URLs. And I think in that tiny little esoteric area, I can see us mowing a lot of the lawn, like maybe, you know, 90, 95% of it, like Steve Springer said, you know, but in any case, right, you know, clear enough of the field that we can keep going forward.
I think this ratcheting effect is a pretty interesting concept. The idea that there is no smooth anything. It just all of a sudden there's a jolt forward and there you are. And it relates, you know, as I age, it relates to the aging process. You know, so you have something that goes wrong with your body and you lose that capability. And, you know, when you're younger, I hurt my hand. That's all right. It'll get better. And a couple of weeks later, it's better and you go on. And when you get older, that doesn't happen that way. Something goes wrong and it gets a little bit better, but never quite gets back to where it was. And now this is the new normal.
Right.
And I think that same sort of ratcheting effect is something, a sort of unconvinced that it's ratcheting up in terms of getting towards a better situation in cybersecurity. But it is, you know, every time there's a new control that gets added, there's not another one removed. So, you know, the one exception, you know, sort of in 20 years was removing the you must change your password every 30-day requirement. 20 years after I pointed out that you shouldn't be doing this, NIST finally agreed with it, National Institute of Standards and Technology, and took it out and said that no longer you need to do that.
And Scott, what's his name, apologized for it, you know,
you know, the problem with most of this stuff is it keeps adding more stuff, not making it better. And that's why security load gets too high. That's, you know, security load explode. It just keeps getting worse and worse, and it gets harder and harder to get your job done until we break it because we can't do our work.
Well, in biology, you talk about punctuated evolution, right? You know, you get these periods, you know, where it's really, really easy. You know, a saber-tooth animals, you know, have happened, I believe, at least 8 or 9 different times. You know, unrelated, you know, not genetically, you know, totally different animal species. You get to this point where there's so much meat walking around that just being huge and having really big teeth works perfectly fine. And then at some point, things change. You know, climate changes, conditions change, and all of a sudden, they all die off, right? You know, so that ratcheting effect I see, yeah, is the same sort of thing. And but to your point, better? I don't know about better. I don't know if it gets better. I think it just, you know, it moves forward.
Yeah, different.
It doesn't get much worse. Yeah.
Yeah, it adapts, but the adaptation has to do with the environment, and the adaptation affects the environment. So they get to where they're in stable equilibrium, never. And so something changes, and so then it flips out, and all of a sudden you have something else. All right. Well, that's
right. I've said this is the last decade of cybersecurity, you know, in the 2020s. You know, partly be contentious, but partly also mean it. You know, that doesn't mean we don't have conflict. It doesn't mean we come up with, you know, don't have all new cybersecurity things, you know, sort of forever. I think we're still in the phase, though, of just defining, you know, the basic components and all just agreeing on what we call things. And that takes 50 years.
Well, there are well-defined names that have existed for 50 years. The problem is that we're in this rapid change, you know, rush forward quickly to meet the new thing. So I think it'll settle down when the rapid evolution of IT settles down. And I don't see that coming anytime soon.
Well, yeah, you know, to your point, you know, the zero trust, you know, used to be called deny by default.
Well, zero trust used to be called a bad idea. Now it's being called a good idea, but it's still a bad idea. So, moving along.
Moving along.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. Next week on The Cyber Show, Roger geeks out on ag tech. Jennifer gets into systems engineering, and man, can she engineer a system. Another pitcher throws a curve. Can we catch it? More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time and bow. A good time and bow. A string-beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.